to visit or an FCC?
Generally, the desire of the NCCC to actually have, as the end state, to have that particular capability, to be able to say, people who are in control of conventional arms are the following, and then they've got an asset register of what they have. But then, again, AMCO had expressed an unqualified support for this approach if you were to deal with it in that particular way. And also the defense industry through the chairperson or through the CEO of Mr. Hamilton, he would be generally comfortable with that, because the intention is we do not want to bog down companies, but we want to create the lines of accounting and responsibility so that we know who has got what, who has sold to who. And the chairperson, I will therefore proceed to deal with other matters that the AMCO had raised. But those were the key ones. Or maybe before I even do that, let me just deal therefore with.
Thanks, chairperson. Thanks, Babujaga. I just want to satisfy myself. And what does it mean? This APC's company A is having 20. Then the 5 correctly disappear. How would you take down as US NCCC? How would you take it down? Is it dependent upon the company to tell you that we have sold 5, or maybe out of 5, out of 20, the 5 they're just defunct, they're no longer absolutely gone absolutely within the company? Does it mean they must still come back to and say 5 were sold or 5 are no longer are not functional? Do you want it to be done that way? Because I'm just also imagining that after 20 years, 30 years, to what extent will these people still be able to come back? And you now, within your own system, what system is there that is able to tell that this company A, we gave them a permission for 20, by now they still be having 20. I just want you to be elaborating on that.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just attempt to respond to the question. I think, firstly, what you're saying here, I think the reality of the situation, Chair, and addressing Honorable Ntuli on this point, is that the concern that there is currently, and that's the reality of the situation, is that you have got people who have got conventional arms out there who are outside of the regulation purview of the NCCC. And that is a concern, so security and otherwise. What we intend doing in terms of this, therefore, is to say, if a company which is authorized, because firstly, we say, a person who deals in conventional arms must be registered with the NCCC. That's the starting point. If you are therefore not registered, you are considered to be an illegal dealer. And therefore, you constitute you are therefore violating the provisions of the Act. But therefore, if you are registered and you therefore say, I deal in APCs, I've got 100 of them, that is fine. But then if you want to sell 5 to another company, the condition of sales are the following, is that you cannot sell to a person who is not registered. You can't sell to a private person who just wants to buy an APC to go to town. You must sell to a person who is registered, who has been vetted, and who's got a very clear reason why he wants to own the APC. That's the starting point. And therefore, the fine does not, you don't just sell an updated. Before you can actually sell over, before you can effect the transfer, you must therefore say, we seek the NCCC authorization to sell the 5 to Company X. And then you'll be given authority to say, you can sell 5 to that company. And once you have done that, what it therefore means is that your register will be minus 5 as a seller, and the buyer will therefore be plus 5 in that other instance. And then the question is, how do we therefore ensure that we keep tabs on these numbers? It's an issue of capacity. We currently have got an inspectorate. All that it does, it visits companies, different companies at different times. And when it descends on them, it requires, amongst other things, the registers of all the assets that they have. And if they were at some point having 100, and now there is a 5 that is missing, they must therefore provide an account of what happened to the 5 APCs. They must therefore be able to produce it and say, we have therefore sold 5 to Company X, and this was the authorization by the NCEC. And that will therefore close their books. And on the other side, if the company is being audited, and it says now it indicates an additional 5, therefore they must be able to account for the 5 and say, look, we have been authorized to accept this by the NCECC. That is how we intend dealing with that. But it will therefore require some constant audit of the company.
I think we have to come back to that because I'm trying to think whether this is captured in any way in the Act rather than just leave it to regulations. I understand that you are talking about the inspector, and it's always your wish, you are saying, that you assume more control. Now, I'm just trying this, even members can comment on this as we move on, to then say, how do we then capture that? So that it must be very clear, because there must be a control, whether we like it or not. Because one question that might as well come up is to then say, what is currently happening, and what was happening in the past? Do we have the right kind of an asset register and audit that has been done by our inspectors to convince us that this is the true picture of what is happening in the various industries? I'm just throwing this deliberately so that we can also look into that, because we have to tighten the screws. I think members will agree that we allow you to proceed so that we can come back to this. You may then.
Thank you, Chair. Let me therefore, Chair, proceed to the issue of the scrutiny committee, which is a clause of common concern to many of the public hearing inputs that has been considered by Parliament. It happens in the points, as we understand them, across, whether it's Catholic Bishops Conference or whether it's ISS, whether it's this fire campaign. Those are basically saying that the scrutiny committee will have the potential of becoming a de facto NCECC. It may, if you're not careful, become the NCECC, and the NCECC becomes the rubber stamp of what the scrutiny committee does. And the other point being raised, particularly by the Catholic bishops, is that the people who are serving on the scrutiny committee, who are those people? And they would love to see additional people being put there to represent particular interests, like your human rights lawyers and development experts and all of that. And the other point by this fire campaign is a point that actually says there is a concern that the people who are serving on the scrutiny committee, as we have indicated here, are basically senior public officials. And as such, they have the potential of actually usurping the power of the NCECC and become the NCECC themselves by default. That is how we understand that. And I think also last week there were some concerns and questions that were posed by the committee itself, and some of them are almost along similar lines. I think, Chairperson, I think to answer that or to respond to this concern, I think I will start by actually saying, what was the reason behind the attempt by the NCECC to bring about the scrutiny committee? Because I think so that we declare our intentions of actually bringing about the scrutiny committee. The intention is basically twofold. And on the first fold, you find that generally, in any public service or any government department, the people who are doing a lot of paperwork and state work and all of that, it is generally the public officials. What the political executives normally does is to actually consider that which has been done, apply their mind to it, and therefore take a decision and be responsible for such a decision. And that is normal practice. And what we are therefore trying to do here was actually to try to give expression to that particular principle or that particular practice in public service. To say, the industry or the companies that apply for permits, they lost their applications with their secretariat, which I'm associated with. The documentation that therefore come to us are such that one, from our level, from my level, I've got to ensure that everything that is submitted is complete in line with the requirements. See if the form is filled in properly. See if all the necessary the supporting documents are there. See if the EUCs are there, if the EUCs will be required in terms of the qualification and all of that. And once we have done that, it is a requirement, therefore, that we must therefore take those applications for a review, meaning I have to seek the input of all government departments that are relevant as part of the review process. We therefore send these documents to specific areas in various departments: Foreign Affairs, SARS, NIA, Police, Defence Department, DTI, and all of that. And then those departments are given a particular period of time to comment on those things and provide their department-specific input. Foreign Affairs will look into politics, and Defence will look into defence interests of the country vis-à-vis the same. NIA would look at the intelligence aspects of that. And once those inputs are provided, they come back to the Secretariat. And it becomes, therefore, the Secretariat's duty to pile or to bring all these things together and say, on application X, these are all the inputs by various departments. And therefore, put them in a format of a booklet that is therefore taken to the NCECC for consideration. And as they do that particular consideration, they do so with a full view of what the various departments are saying on every possible application that is there. But what scrutiny committee has done, and I think we said last week, that scrutiny committee is not a new entity. It has been in operation for quite a number of years now. And what we are seeking to do is just to formalize that particular institution. What it does, once the inputs have been received from various departments, there is a meeting, therefore, that is held, and where, therefore, as part of the Secretariat, I therefore present and say, there is Company X, let's say AMSCO, for instance. AMSCO wants to sell to Country Y, and this is what they want to sell. This is what the various departments are saying. And therefore, there is a deliberation on that application. And as they do so, they deliberate in full view of what the provisions of the Act are. Section 15 is taken into account, all the provisions of the Act. And once the deliberation is complete on a particular aspect, then therefore there is a recommendation that actually says, we are, as the scrutiny committee, of the view that we can recommend this thing for approval or not. And once those recommendations are made, and I again take those recommendations with the documentation and say, these are the applications that I have received, this is the input I got from various departments, and this is what the scrutiny committee had done, it had recommended. And therefore the NCECC considers that. It does not just say scrutiny committee yes or no, but it looks into the matter and therefore decides either to accept the recommendation or to reject it. And that is how it generally works. But all that it does, the scrutiny committee does not, in its current form, take any powers of the NCECC. The NCECC remains 100% responsible for the decision that come out. It does not, for a second, assume certain responsibilities. All that it does work on behalf of the NCECC and therefore bring that to before the NCECC for a decision. Why we therefore want to formalize the scrutiny committee is the following. Is that, firstly, there has been, as you consider these applications, sometimes the scrutiny committee can therefore say, listen, this application, we see what has been provided, But can we request the company to provide us with additional information on aspect 1 and 2? And as a secretary, therefore, my duty is to go back to the company and say, look, the scrutiny committee and all of that, we request additional information on 1, 2, and 3. What the company said, therefore, said, which was understandable under the circumstances, was that, what are you talking about? Has the NCCC considered the matter? And the answer would be no, because they have not. Then they say, well, I can't subject myself to scrutiny committee because I can't see that structure is non-existent in terms of the law. That has been the concern. The concern from the Auditor General has been saying, when they are auditing, because Auditor General audits the affairs of the NCCC from beginning to end. And when they are looking at all that, they look at the secretariat, look at the vetting, looking at the security clearance of the people working there, and look at all the processes. And then they say, this committee called scrutiny committee, what is it that it does? And where is the constitution for this thing? Who serves onto it? And what kind of powers do they have and all of that? One proposal that they had therefore said was to say, look, draw up a constitution to establish this so that it can perform according to a particular constitution. Or the other proposal can be therefore to formalize this so that it can be formalized either in the act or in the regulation. They had no issue where you want to put it, but they wanted a formalization of that particular institution. The third concern, Chair, about that has been that Section 7 of the Act currently says the NCCC can establish subcommittees, and those subcommittees should be established with a particular purpose. They must have a very clear task to perform, and there must be a time frame attached to that. And thirdly, a member of the NCCC must therefore sit on those subcommittees. But practically, what you therefore see is that the NCCC, the scrutiny committee, is not time-bound. It has always been there. And is not only doing a particular job and dissolve after that. It's always there. So it is not consistent with the provision of the subcommittee. And thirdly, there has never been a member of the NCCC sitting on this subcommittee called scrutiny committee, if you want to look at it as a subcommittee. So there has been an inconsistency between the practice and the law in terms of the subcommittee. What we are trying to do, therefore, is to actually look and try to marry that and try to find reconciliation between these processes. And that, Chairperson, is the intention behind the proposal of scrutiny committee. Scrutiny committee will never assume any powers. The NCCC remains 100% responsible for whatever decision that comes out. But Chairperson, we have looked into these concerns, and last week also the concerns expressed by members of this committee. We are therefore of the opinion, as the department, that we'll be guided by the committee in some of these aspects. But to us, all that we seek is to formalize an institution that would help the NCCC to do some speech work for the NCCC. Whether that is done in the legislation or in the regulations, I think we are quite easy insofar as that is concerned. But then, if we take it to the level of putting it in the regulation, what we'll therefore propose to do is to amend the Section 7 of the Act that talks about subcommittees, so that we can create a platform for the for the scrutiny committee to operate. It may not operate under the name scrutiny committee. We must say that the word scrutiny committee may also not be the term that is being used to describe the committee. We may therefore call it a subcommittee, but we will therefore want to address the issue of the time so that we don't have to have it time-bound. We also want to address the issue of one member of the NCCC sitting there. So if we go through regulations, we would request that we amend that particular section. But we are at the we would seek your guidance on that, Chairperson. But basically, these were the reasons why the scrutiny committee was established, and this is how we would want to see the matter moving forward.
I just suggesting that when you established it some years ago, you did not establish it under the terms and conditions of Section 7. I'm asking this because here you are telling me then that the auditor came up to them say, please define for us this subcommittee. Was it that difficult for you to say, in terms of Section 7, that is why we established this particular subcommittee? Why do they then come up and then say, we want these specifics around this? Why was it because of the powers that are run by this particular subcommittee? Because Section 7 does give yourself to establish subcommittees. Thank you very much. I think the difficulties are exactly with regard to that. Although Section 7 empowers the NCAC to establish subcommittees, but if you read the wording of that section, it is clear that what was envisaged was a breakaway group of the MCACC. In other words, at the level of ministers, not at the level of officials. I think that's where the difficulty is. Because you cannot use Section 7 to establish subcommittee if you look at its composition as it said, because it's at an official level. So I think that's where the difficulty is. So you really cannot justify it in terms of Section 7, because that's not what is envisaged there. Thank you, Chair.
Okay.
Okay, so I'll therefore move away from the scrutiny committee issue. We will therefore come to the issue of reports, which is another issue that is of common concern across. Or maybe before I move off scrutiny committee, there are some who are expressing support for that. I must say that. Even in the public hearing, I think the defense industry is one group that expresses a support for scrutiny committee. But the next issue, say, is the issue of reports. I think from the very get-go on the reports, I think we have acceded, we have said last week that we are prepared to go back to the normal terminology used the last time of disclosure and non-disclosure and actually do away with the report, because I think the intention was not necessarily to change even the name, but to change some of the things, the kind of disclosures that we'll be making. So we'll retain the heading as it stands in the Principal Act that says disclosures and non-disclosures. But our understanding, therefore, of the all the inputs put together is that they seem to express one similar concern. And the concern is that the information that is actually provided or released by the NCACC is insufficient. And they would want to see more information provided than it currently is the case. Last week there was a lengthy discussion around the kind of information that the NCACC provides, both to Parliament as well as to the UN. And in our understanding, was that there was some kind of a general agreement that there should be a reconciliation found between the information that South Africa provides to the UN as well as the information that South Africa provides, that the NCACC provides to Parliament, so that the two reports actually stick to each other. We don't have one institution getting more information than it is with the other institution. And I think we are proceeding from that very, very basis that actually says the level of information that is provided should actually be consistent, both at the UN level as well as at the Parliament level. But the other point, Jay has been saying, even if you were to try to achieve some reconciliation between the two, but they would want to see further information actually provided. Currently, the Act says you will provide information related to the exports conducted in the previous year. And if you carefully look through all those the wording around Section 23, what is very clear is that it only confines itself to exports. And insofar as exports is concerned, and it therefore talks about certain things, that such information will therefore have to provide the type, the quantity, and the value of those particular transactions. Type, quantity, and value. But our understanding, therefore, of these inputs is that that seems to be insufficient. We had deposited last week was we hear that the report that the NCECC currently provides, forgetting about for a second chairperson, the issue of the timing of the reporting, but just the content and what is reported on, is that it does talk about type, quantity, and value. It says sales to country X, the type, category A, is it category A, and the value, meaning the value in rand terms, what that is. So the NCECC view is that they had remained, in terms of content of the report, they have been consistent with the provisions of the Act. However, there has been concerns around additional information, imports, transit permits, and all of that. But that, at the time when this law was actually drafted, I think there was an unwitting exclusion of such information. There was no reference to imports to South Africa. There was no reference to items that traverse through the South African territory as transit or conveyance, as it were. And generally, then, if such information is to be provided, it's very clear that it has to be, therefore, in line with what the law requires. But the NCECC is generally saying we are prepared to provide any kind of information that Parliament wants to see. And I think that's what the Minister of Defence said last week. If Parliament wants whatever kind of information, we are prepared to bring that information to this committee or to any committee of Parliament to declare the information. I think we are coming from that particular perspective, Chairperson. However, the issue at hand, insofar as the inputs are concerned, is that you see they are not part of Parliament. And as such, information that is delivered to Parliament, the question is, how does it therefore find its way out to the general public? And the Minister last week was here, had stated very clearly that we will therefore have to work a way with Parliament to say what kind of information that we would want to see going out to the public and what kind of information we would love to see remaining within the confines of the parliamentary perimeter. And I think, Chairperson, we are not departing at all from those particular statements by the Minister, and we are still committed to those particular statements. So insofar as these disclosures are concerned, we are, therefore, saying we would work out a way, well, with the guidance of the committee, to say how best can we work around an amending of this section in a manner that gives expression to these particular agreements that I see to be emerging around the kind of information. But what ISS has done, which was a much more positive input, was to actually draw reports from other countries and actually say, let's compare ourselves to other countries. Let's see what the UK, US, Canada, Germany does insofar as it's concerned. What is very clear, therefore, from those countries is that they do provide information to the general public. And that information actually talks to much more detail. It just says sale of category A, it's category A equipment, and the category A is attack helicopter, is Corvette, is missiles, is this and that and the other. And the value of that is that, and the quantities are that. We just say some countries are doing that. And what the minister had therefore said is that such information, we've got such information, but we need therefore to be guided whether it could therefore be discussed or to be disclosed to that level. But I think how to address the issue of the level of information to be disclosed, I think should be informed by what kind of damage would the NCECC suffer? Or what kind of damage would South Africa suffer if it were to disclose the level and kind of information as other countries are doing? And I think that should be the kind of test that we actually apply to this particular aspect. But the damage, there was also another issue maybe just before I come back to the test of the damage. The whole issue of saying what kind of disclosures, and there are certain limitations that sometimes creep in on disclosure. Confidentiality clauses, commercial risk, and this and that and the other. So those constitute some limitations that we are supposed to comply with. But the NCECC is saying the law that we administer or the law that the NCCC administer does not supersede the laws that govern disclosure and non-disclosure of information. So whatever the NCCC does should be consistent and be in line with what PAJA says, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. It must be consistent with what the Promotion of Access to Information Act provides. And that is why, therefore, in this section, we are saying whatever information that the NCCC will be actually limiting in terms of disclosure, such limitation would be effected in a manner that is in line with the relevant laws that govern that. And if you go to those laws, if you go to PIA, for instance, which is the Promotion of Access to Information Act, there is a whole section that talks about grounds of actually refusing to disclose information. And therefore, we're saying, and security interest is one of the grounds. Foreign relations interest is one of the grounds, is another ground. Commercial interest, another part. So we are saying, therefore, the level of information that we provide here will therefore be to the extent that those grounds of exclusion actually provide for. But I must say that practically, the number of contracts that have got limitation clauses, I think we must say they are limited. Let's just be very upfront about that. Not all of them have those particular clauses. And therefore, it's not just that every other contract has got a limitation clause. Some of them do not have. There may be some limitations insofar as the contract is being negotiated. But once it is sealed and delivered, and some of the limitations that normally attach to the negotiations actually fall away. So we are saying, Chairperson, the level of information that we have to, when we are saying the test is therefore the ground of non-disclosure. So basically, Chairperson, that is what we intend dealing with this section. We're saying the information provided to the UN should be similar to that provided to Parliament. So that is to say, the level of will go beyond now categories. Because you see, at the level of the UN, we're providing much more than categories. We are saying we sold category A to Germany, and their category A is a missile, or is an attack helicopter, or is this and that and the other. And I'm just saying, we have to look into that particular direction. Obviously, taking into account all the security interests that are there, because as I said, some could, you may therefore use the section, whatever section of PIA, to actually defend non-disclosure of that. What the defense industry has said in their proposal is that they would want to see provision of information must relate to export, import, contracting, conveyance, as well as ownership and re-export. I think our view, Chair, is that insofar as that is concerned, I think information on exports we already provide. All that we need to do is to amend the law in a manner that therefore talks about details on the category. And that is applicable, therefore, to imports as well as contracting, as well as transit. But the difficulty that we're going to have in this instance, in the case of the defense industry, is to provide information around ownership, because they want information on ownership to say who owns what company and all of that. We are saying, I think such an aspect will therefore not necessarily fall within the parameters of what the NCC stands for, because we are regulating the movement of or transfer or conventional arms and possession of that. I think issues about who owns what percentage and is information that is readily available at CIPRO as part of DTI, because you see, whatever you do in terms of sales of equity and shares and all of that, such information is updated at the level of CIPRO. So Chairperson, that is how we generally want to deal with Section 23, dealing with disclosure and non-disclosure of information.
Yes.
Or insofar as reports are concerned.
Now I'm going to hear from the members whether we want now to engage on those as it has been put before us, or we allow them also to get into the finer details of other issues that they've come up with, which I then think are more technical. Question of the wording and all that, the definition. What is the view of the committee?
Chair, I think in order for us to maintain our thoughts, because we've still got a long way to go in the discussion, my suggestion would be, hopefully we have been taking note of some of the responses, perhaps we should just deal with what has happened up to this point in terms of the issues raised, and then we can proceed for ease. Thank you.
Dr. Skuman.
Thank you. Chair, I do think that it is going to be important that we see in what way the problems that have arisen, how it can be accommodated, and around the scrutiny committee.
Just before that, are we agreeing, Dr. Korenoff, with the proposal that is coming up with us, Sean?
I just want to find out how far is the presentation. If we're close to the end, I would suggest that we finish this presentation and then start from the scratch. Otherwise, we need to go back either to the scrutiny committee or to the section 23. So if the presenter can indicate to us how far are they, is it another few minor issues or is it substantial issues they want to address, then I think we must discuss it up to this point in time. If they're near to the finish, let them finish and then we start from scratch.
Mr. Angela, Mr. Lana.
I think Chairperson knows how we intend moving forward. I think we have the document. I think the comments that I hear are both editorial and some of them are substance. And I think on the substance issue, I think I've tried to deal with some. I think there's just few that we want to address. But on the editorial aspect, I think we'll want to deal with those as we come to the line by line reading, because they are largely editorial as opposed to being substantial.
Yeah.
So that's how we want to move forward. Yeah.
There it is, members. Dr. Kolonov, you're comfortable with that? Okay.
I think, Chairperson, if one just to draw your attention to the first page of the submission, that we can just tell you what is substance and what is actually not. I think under definition, under the AMCO, under 4A1, and we think that the issue of procuring services, I think, is an issue of editorial. We'll just get rid of that. Competent authority, Chairperson, I think also that is a matter of interpretation, but we retain our position. It's also editorial in a sense. I have therefore dealt with the issue of brokering and possession, Chair, and I would want therefore not to repeat dealing with that. And Roman Figure 5, Chair, the 2.5, the destroyed instruction is editorial, services is editorial, transfer I've provided some substantial input to it already. Possession, I've dealt with it substantially. Amendment B, Section 3, Roman Figure 1 is actually editorial, as well as almost all the entire subsection 4, because possession there, once we concede, so you'll effectively deal with that. So from Roman Figure 1 to 4, we can deal with that. We can dispense with that. Section 7A, which is the D part, is put in a committee. We have expressed ourselves on that one. Section 9, which is on page 3 of the document, which is trade-in. Again, to us, that is a matter of edit. Um, And Chair, the issue of subsection 13, as it is expressed over there, the whole lot, all of it, from Romantica 1 to 5, those are editorial comments. Dual use groups, and the people are asking questions, how we'll deal with that. I think we can provide, I don't know whether I should, but I can provide a little bit of feedback onto that. On Roman figure 1, I think the issue there, dual use items, we said last week that dual use items, the items that have got dual application, they can be used in civilian environment as well as in military environment. But what you therefore do not want to end up with is a situation where you control, you put the same stringent rules around this equipment as you would do on the equipment that is a clear-cut military. So we want therefore to propose less stringent rules around that, but we'll provide details around it in the regulation. But generally, they will be less stringent than it currently is the case insofar as military equipment is concerned. And I think therefore it's just the matter of putting generally less stringent requirements on the control or transfer of those items. Let me just say, as an example, we are currently confronted from time to time, you find certain items being bought by universities for testing purposes at their laboratory, engineering department, for instance. 2 weeks back, I had to deal with an equipment or a material called a boron, which they use to manufacture grinding equipment. And that can also be used both for making of mining equipment as well as making some of the military equipment so that it becomes so hard in terms of penetration or resistance to penetration. So, but it's material. All that it requires further processing before it becomes of any value. So the question therefore is, you do not want therefore to have the professors at universities going through this process and because all that you end up with is just some powder, and that powder can therefore be used, but it's for non-dangerous purposes. It's just for equipment. So I'm just saying, that is one aspect of dual use goods. There's quite a lot of others, computers and this and that. So
quite interesting. Why did they have to come to you? Because I think it's accessible somewhere else, the powder.
Not necessarily, but then you see, dual use, these goods, for instance, the German authorities, they want therefore to see South Africa to say, as a general rule, they want to know whether you are familiar with, as the South African Arms Control Authority, the institution that wants to buy boron, is it a recognized institution in South Africa? So we have to confirm that insofar as registration is concerned, yes, they are registered with the Department of Education, they do this kind of work, and insofar as arms control is concerned, we've got no objection to them having it. But if they therefore manufacture something that would become military, and therefore they must therefore come to the fold. But if they ever continue to manufacture plowing equipment, we've got no issue with that. That's generally how dual use goods operate. So but we'll deal with the details of that in the regulation, at the regulation level. The G is editorial, Chair. Amendment 17 is also editorial. That is section 22, is also editorial because it relates to possession and control items. And 24, again, is also largely editorial. The NERS Dynamics Chairperson on page 3, they had raised an issue, and their issue is that it was a general practice and administrative issue, which is not a matter of law. And we therefore said whatever they were proposing there is a matter of administrative exercise, and it can be dealt with as such. It is not a matter of law. I think the whole paragraph under the ISS, the whole paragraph 6, has to do with the report, and I think we've tried to deal with the reporting. So we will therefore dispense with that for now. Maybe the point, Chair, that I would want to address is the issue of EUCs, and I think it's an issue that I addressed last week, and I would continue to do so now. We have proposed in the legislation that currently, in terms of this law, you are required, if you are buying a South African equipment, control item, that is a conventional arm, to provide an undertaking as the buying government or the buying state or the buyer, that you will not, therefore, export, forward sell that item without the consent of South Africa. Why is that done? The reason is South Africa would want, as a general rule in defense industry, you would want to have control of your conventional arms from cradle to grave. You do not want your items to end up in a country that you do not necessarily approve of, as South Africa. So you want, therefore, to subject the person who, therefore, buys your equipment to a requirement that if you want to sell it, even if after 10 years or 15 years, he must come back to you and say, I bought a Roy Falk from South Africa in 19, whatever, it could have been 20 years ago. We want to sell the Roy Falk to country X. And therefore, South Africa must consent and say, we have got no problem with that. And therefore, they can sell. Even right now, we can't. Therefore, they can't. These are the restrictions that are there. This is the practice in this industry, and it's accepted as such. However, there are other practical difficulties, and many of the countries which have got a strong defense industry, many of the European countries, America and others, they are starting to say there is a reality that you need to provide exemptions to the EUC for the simple reason that some of the items that are exported by defense industry are not complete systems. Are small component parts. I think I must say, this has to do with component parts. And the component parts, they are exported to countrywide, and countrywide integrate these component parts into a big system. There could be 1,000 of those component parts bought from South Africa to a particular system. Let's just take a Corvette. Germany can buy small component parts and put them in a Corvette. And those assets, those items can be a negligible percentage of the covert system. But if you place, therefore, a requirement of the EEC on this, that will say the entire covert system will not go anywhere until such time that they come back and put a request to export this thing to another country. The problem, therefore, with that, if you've got 1,000 or 2,000, you're going to have 2,000 requests for consent on each one of them. To consent to sell this thing forward. But our understanding of arms control as a discipline is that it seeks to promote accountability and responsibility. And therefore, in this instance, what you want to do is to say, if Germany, I'm just using Germany as an example, if Germany is buying the component parts from South Africa, their component parts, we will therefore, if the company that is concerned applies for an exemption, we would consider that exemption, but we're creating a platform for a particular consideration. So that at the end of it, you look at the merit and demerit of the application. You say, how is the arms control system of Germany, for instance, because that is the question that you have to ask, like it or not. Who is the end user? What is the arms control system around it and all of it? Because if they sell it to the UK, they sell the Corvette to the UK, a system will therefore have an EUC. And if you want to create accountability, South Africa can say, Germany, we sold you 20 of these component parts. Where did you put them? Then they will say, we put them in a Corvette. Then the next question is, where did you sell the Corvette to? Then they say, we sold it to the UK. And here is an EUC for that particular system. And therefore, if you still want to see your component parts, you will therefore go to UK and you find them there. Because even UK cannot forward sell this thing if they don't come to Germany. So to us, this whole accountability process is not interfered with if you're providing for exemption. We are not talking about exemption in the case of systems. I must be very clear, very upfront. We're talking about component parts. And that is the reality of business. And I think, therefore, we are saying we want to promote that. Everybody, many of the countries who are big defense industry, they are doing that already. Currently, in South Africa, you start to have companies buying share. No. South African companies being bought by foreign companies. You can talk about, as you can see, some stakes of billions, some equities in general being bought by foreign companies. And what you end up with is a movement of component parts between South African entity of BAE and the entity in the UK. Rheinmetall in Germany, Rheinmetall in South Africa, SAP in Sweden, SAP in South Africa. And if you're not careful, you may therefore end up with an administrative hassle that you may not even begin to think about. So all that you say, we're not frustrating accountability. All that we are doing is to say we facilitate this movement of items, but accountability is not undermined at all. Chairperson, I will therefore continue to just on this document. There is a whole issue of staffing of the directorate secretary. I think that is a matter that we are dealing with separately, but I think the concern is noted here. The control item, the next item there, it talks about control items. What we are saying there, we're taking the terminology now, conventional control items, and under control items, we're going to have dual-use goods, conventional arms, and services. But a person would, at any given point in time, know exactly what is the control items, because we're going to publish lists on each one of them. There is a list of conventional arms, list of dual-use goods, list of services which are controlled. And if anything is not part of that, and that would generally not be controlled. And such lists will be updated as frequently as possible. But what you therefore cannot do under this thing is to actually confine yourself to say, you want to do these things on 2 times a year or once a year, because the change of the list should be informed by the developments in the industry. For instance, in the dual-use goods industry, you will find that something that is controlled today, 5 years down the line, it becomes common technology. You don't want to control that. So you may not therefore be forced to publish something on an annual basis, even if the technology has not changed, because we want to create a list that says these are controlled items. Until that time that they start to be of a particular status, we would want to retain the list. So you may consider then to do it annually, but you cannot just confine yourself to time to say every 6 months you must have that, because you may find that nothing might have changed at that time. You may therefore publish the list for purposes of just publishing, but the contents would remain fairly the same. So we are saying, but the question is, how do you therefore arrive at the list? Because that's a question that people ask. And we are saying, you know, the issue of the list, most of them may not necessarily be an issue that may be of, it depends how far you want to take it. Our view is that currently South Africa subscribes to what is called the Wassenaar Arrangement. Wassenaar Arrangement is a group of countries with defense industries. They've got a dedicated technical capacity that determines all the analysis of conventional arms and dual-use goods and services. What you want to do then, you may not say, in South Africa, an APC is not controlled, but in another country, it is controlled, because there should be consistency in how you control things internationally. And we are saying there's already certain institutions that work around developing lists of things that are controlled. If you are saying, today, what is an attack helicopter? An attack helicopter would therefore be defined in certain accepted international documents. That says an attack helicopter is something that has got the following features. All that you can therefore do is not to add to that. You may add, not to minus. So we are saying, Chairperson, whether that, if we were to call a public hearing on conventional arms, and we spend some time on defining what an attack helicopter is, we're saying you may therefore defeat the whole purpose. But we're saying those lists will be published, but they'll be published under a particular system that Parliament will be aware of. We can engage with Parliament around the list. But whether we want to have public hearings on that is another point. Actually, let me just proceed. My colleague here is just the Catholic Bishop, Chairperson, they are talking about the first point there, about the 90-day reporting and publishing of the they're talking about the 90 days to say, if the Act comes into force, we want to see certain things being done within 90 days. And we'll say again, I think proposing times, you run the risk of being non-compliant. We can't from the very beginning realistic of the fact that there are certain things that you may do, and therefore put some of these times that can be as tight as that, 90 day and all of it. It can be done within reasonable time, but I don't know whether you'd want to put a time frame for that. The objects of the committee, I think they are supportive of that. Within the committee, we have dealt with that. Possession of controlled items dealt with that. Reports, we have dealt with that. Exemption. In this case, Chair, this exemption, may I just address that for a second? I said last week when we were presenting the contents of the bill that this exemption is applicable to the SANDF and the SAPS exclusively, not to any other person. Why it is here, we're saying some other time these institutions are required to deploy certain, some of their people, some of their operatives as well as the equipment on the shortest possible time. And depending on the nature of the operation they're engaged in, you may therefore find that a lot of discussion around the deployment of that may actually compromise the very essence of that particular deployment. And all that we are saying is that there should be exemption given, but it's not a blanket exemption. We're saying there could be deployment of that, but the minister who is the chair of the NCCC plus one member of the NCCC must therefore authorize such a deployment of equipment, because we are concerned about equipment in this instance. And such an authorization will therefore be ratified by the next ensuing meeting of the NCCC, just to ratify that. But all that we're just trying to do is not to compromise certain operations which may be of security interest to the country, but at the same time, we're not undermining the accountability, responsibility of those particular institutions in terms of equipment deployed and when they're going to bring it back. The next one, Chairperson, is page 5, which is the I think they are happy with a particular comment. This fire campaign. Chair, I must just say that the submission by this fire campaign has been the most difficult to interpret. We have read this input over and over again. I think it has been the most difficult to interpret. But what is here is just our interpretation of what the this fire campaign was saying. And we thought our interpretation maybe was the closest to what they intended to bring across. 17, paragraph 17 is the editorial, Chair. The issue of section 5, or 18, paragraph 18 in terms of this. I think this is put in the committee, it's dealt with already. 19 is editorial, 20 editorial. Maybe let's just reflect on that because it's much more important. That is editorial, but we may have to reflect on it. I think in the bill, what appears is that we are seeming to be wanting to amend the function or the duty of the Auditor General insofar as the NCCC is concerned. Currently, they are required to audit the processes and registers of the NCCC. When we consulted with them last year, they had indicated to us that they would want to see this amendment. They want to see an amendment of this section to include that they want to be able to audit all the affairs of the NCCC, meaning financial records, registers, processes, and everything. But maybe in the process of drafting, as well as I think we lost that it was not supposed to be saying financial. It was supposed to be affairs of the NCCC, meaning that we're actually expanding the scope of the Auditor General. We're not confining them to particular things. And I think it's editorial, but I needed just to reflect on that. Section 10, again, it's editorial. We'll deal with that maybe later. 11, again, is another one that has been hard for us to understand. And 14, I think, is about exemptions, and we've dealt with exemptions already insofar as EUCs are concerned. Section 20... is the whole issue that of exemption to the SANDF, we've dealt with that. Foreign military assistance, I think, is an issue that they are raising, which is were particular to this institution. I think the issue about the Foreign Ministerial Assistance Act is that maybe there is a concern whether the Mercenary Activities Act may not be implemented if these amendments and the answer is, though the two are related, but I think the implementation of the prohibition of mercenary activities can actually proceed without necessarily, even if these are amendments not made. So they are not, they are related, but they are not a precondition of it being implemented. So all that we are saying, and I think we said last week, that the regulations under this thing are under draft at present. The reason why we are being very meticulous, we want to go through a careful process, is that this act, you recall, Chairperson, that during the public hearing, there were a lot of concerns that were expressed around that. And we want therefore the regulations to be as comprehensive as possible and not to leave anything to doubt or to just any other interpretation. That is why we're doing so. But at some point, we therefore indicate to Parliament that these regulations are complete, and now we are therefore bringing this act into operation. But what we are doing here is just to find some reconciliation so that the NCCC is given mandate to administer the Mercenary Activities Act. But in the founding legislation of the NCCC, there is no such reference. All that we're trying to do is just to create harmony between the two legislations. Chair, I'll proceed to the defense industry point. They are raising a particular point here about multiple exports and imports. And I think, Chairperson, we will be dealing with that largely in the regulations. But the concern that they have, I think at the end, our intent is to provide for a mechanism to provide for multiple exports and import permits. And however, that will be the measure to be dealt with at the level of regulations. 29 is editorial, Chairperson. Employer competence is more editorial. Clause 9 is the issue of Porta General. Again, we've already explained ourselves with regard to that. 31, again, I think they're asking what is the value. And I think the value that you're referring to in this instance is the financial value. Maybe we need to, but it's an editorial aspect again. Destroy it domestically. The question that they have been asked was, when items are being imported to South Africa for destruction, do they require a permit? And the answer is yes. Because to us, whether they are coming for destruction or for further use, the point is, these items, when they come to South Africa, they are control items, and therefore we would want to issue them a permit if they are control items. The end destination is not too much of an issue, but if an APC from country X in Europe is to be destroyed by Diner in the Western Cape, because at the time when it comes, it's a complete system, it must have a permit. Therefore, they must have data that it has been destroyed after that. Re-export, to us, re-export and export, it is just one and the same thing, because every time something comes out, it's an export. So we want to deal with re-export as export. The two are related. I think confidentiality is the whole issue that we have dealt with under reports, and I think the committee is going to give us much more guidance on that. And the whole issue of annual reports. Maybe under this annual report, the interesting thing about what the defense industry has said, they put in an interesting arrangement where they are saying they would want to see the NCCC operating like the MPC of the Reserve Bank, where every after 3 months, and therefore there will be the chair of the NCCC who will call the media and address certain points. But we feel that may not necessarily be appropriate for this kind of business. We think reporting to Parliament and reporting through the normal report would serve the same purpose. Fine. The defense industry expressed the concern and said if they agree with the administrative penalty proposal. But they're saying, if you therefore find, some companies have got subsidiaries and this and that and the other, and if you find the holding company, you may therefore bankrupt them. That's what Mr. Hamilton has said. And therefore we agree that we will therefore confine our penalties to the defense-related component of that particular company. 37, Chairperson, I think Interstate asked the question to say, in terms of exemptions, to say, are the exemptions we are given to the SANDF as well as to the SAPS, such that equipment can therefore be bought without necessarily following the normal tender process? Our intent here was not to deal with tendering. I think tendering is a different story. The intent here is for deployment and coming back. I think tendering, when Defense Department acquires equipment, capital equipment and all, they are required by law to follow the normal tender process. And I think this is not departure from that. We are not interfering with that arrangement at all. 38% is a matter of administration. It's a procedure matter that I think we'll deal with administratively. Structural relationship, and I think we again say, when you bring up the structures, NCCC, Secretariat, Inspectorate, maybe scrutiny committee, if it gets established formally, you must therefore in the regulations define the relationship between, so that there is no confusion about the extent of their obligations and responsibilities. The other point, as the last point, is the whole issue of saying who is in charge? Is it the Minister of Defense or is it the Chairperson? And that's what I said. I think the context will largely determine the use of the word. Because to us, the NCCC currently, all the work of the NCCC is done by the Secretariat and the Inspectorate and all of. But those institutions are under Defense Department. We get employed by Defense Department. I draw my salary from Defense Department. So there's certain responsibility that the Minister of Defense has over the administration. But that does not interfere, I must be able to say. The Minister of Defense does not have power to say, issue a permit for this country. Such powers lie with the NCCC. Because they must therefore apply their minds in terms of whatever criteria and therefore decide. Once they've decided, therefore it comes over to Defense Department Secretary for actual implementation. So you therefore find that the context determines the use of the tool. But it has been a very interesting thing. I think the state law advisor and the drafting team will spend some time defining that aspect, and we therefore agreed that that was the best way of dealing with it. Without undermining the NCCC's obligation, at the same time, positioning the admin part within a particular budget line, which is Defense Department. And Chairperson, that brings me to the end of this. This is just our feedback on the public hearing input. And I hand over to you.
Quite interesting, the last one. Very, very interesting. I think members will zoom into that truly, because I'm saying this so to allow members to also think about a situation where now you find the Minister of Defense also serving in the committee, in the NCACC committee, and you draw your salary, as you say, but the key decisions that you maintain, that they align with yourselves, and the Minister of Defense can't put a finger on it. Quite interesting. I know it's a cabinet committee, but quite interesting indeed. I'll take Dr. Skuman, I'll take Mr. Shah, I'll take Mr. Nombeko, Dr. Korenov,
thank you. I'd like to thank Mr. Tata. I think he's assisted us a lot in his presentation. However, as far as the scrutiny committee is concerned, as you quite rightly said, there were a lot of reservations even expressed by this committee. And he mentioned that the whole concept of formalizing the scrutiny committee wasn't to in any way to usurp the powers of the NCACC. I would just like to know from him, in view of Section 11 of the Act, and the old delegation of responsibility which is listed there, how he would bring those two together, and would he think, in order to alleviate the concerns which were expressed, that one must also look at Section 11 and the delegation which is allowed there. Then the other question, which also relates to a common concern, was the reporting, which he mentioned. However, he did elaborate on the quality and the quantity of reports as far as also providing information regarding imports and the granting of transit permits, etc. But no mention was made about the concern. I think you did mention the 90-day with the annual reporting, but also the concern, which is that the quarterly reports are being done away with, that it would seem that there's a general opinion that the quarterly reports should and must be retained. Then just a last question, and that is the question regarding the financial implications of this bill, and that the fact that it is said that there are no financial implications. While a common complaint has been the capacity of this committee, and the excuse for doing away with the quarterly reports is attributed to the lack of capacity and financial resources, etc. So I would just like to receive some answers on those issues. There are some others which we will raise later. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also would like to thank Mr. Tadla for shedding light on many issues, which I think I had some concerns. You have addressed some of them. But in other case, I would like further elaboration. My first question relates to the scrutiny committee. You rightfully said that the purpose of the NCACC is to enhance accountability and responsibility. And I understand that the scrutiny committee is already there is an existing committee that is functioning with the same purpose. And I also understand that the objective of the scrutiny committee, as you said, in respect of legislating now, for the scrutiny committee is actually to facilitate the process and to increase capacity. Is that what I'm understanding? To increase the capacity of the committee to function. Because previously you were not providing timely reports, and some of the reasons given were that lack of capacity. So what I'm understanding now, if I'm not understanding correctly, you can correct me, is that the scrutiny committee is going to actually help enhance the capacity of the NCAC. May I argue that all government departments have a head of department and also corresponding ministers overall in charge of the department, and you have a director general, then you have officials and functionaries. Now, those functionaries and officials in those departments have a job description and a mandate. and a contract. That's what they're there to do. My question is, why should it be any different for the NCACC? You have the cabinet, and then you have the directorate and the secretariat and officials. You have the committee, in your words, which is already has been functioning now. What I need to understand is, why do we need legislation? The reason you gave for legislation was that at times companies that apply for permits, etc., may not be taking that functionary seriously. Now, that's not the case in other government departments. If somebody from a particular department demands a particular clarity or further documentation, etc., in order to facilitate a permit, for example, I mean, permits are applied for in other departments as well, but there are people responsible for it there, but they don't need a separate legislation now for them. That is already their task and job to do. So I'm not yet fully comfortable, I would be comfortable if you could convince me that you actually need a legislation for the scrutiny committee, because people won't be taking those functionaries seriously. So in terms of the scrutiny committee, that's what I would like you to answer, that other government departments also delegate responsibility. You see, as the Dr. Konoff is not here, yesterday he raised this question, and I agree with him, that functions can be delegated, not responsibility. So the committee can receive, be delegated a responsibility, but do you need a legislation to actually give them authority and powers for them to do their work? My second question relates to the issue of prohibition of disclosure in terms of a contract, as proposed in Section 23B, Roman numeral 2, whereby the quantity of the control item involved would be subjected to a confidentiality clause in the sales contract itself. My first question in respect of that would be, does it only refer to quantity and not nature and quality? Because there's a difference. If I'm saying I don't want to disclose 20 bottles of water. No, 20 bottles. But I don't say it's sparkling water, plain water, or it is water at all. So when you say quantity, it doesn't speak to quality and nature of the product. That's not referred, it's not dealt with here. Am I confusing you? When somebody says it's going to be in the contract 20 planes, what planes? Cessnas, what? Is he saying that the nature and quality of that equipment also should not be disclosed? He doesn't say so. The second part of the question would be, does this confidentiality clause in any way going to affect and influence the NCACC's responsibility to report to Parliament and to this committee, through this committee? Are you saying to me that if you have signed a contract with another company or country, that you will not disclose 20 bottles of water, that the Parliament has no right to actually fulfill it? How are we going to fulfill our oversight responsibility over something that we don't know about? So it would be unacceptable if that disclosure, confidentiality clause, is going to affect your responsibility to report to Parliament. Is it going to be so, or am I wrong? My third question is in respect of reporting. It is true that in the past the NCACC has failed in providing Parliament with reports timely. It is true that we have noticed a lack of information in your reports. In fact, I think you, in many ways, that report is an insult to the integrity of Parliament, because you're quite comfortable reporting much more in detail to the United Nations and other organs, international bodies. And you don't feel that that information is kosher for Parliament, and that we can't be trusted with that information. So I question the quality of the reports, and I think it ought to be more detailed and more elaborate. In terms of requesting that it be an annual and not a quarterly report, well, you've never reported quarterly before. What's to say that it's going to be true in the case of this request of an annual report? Well, you haven't reported in cases where sometimes 2 years. Two other questions for clarity, Chair, with your permission. The issue of transfer. You said it means title of ownership transfer from one entity or one person to another, and I understand that point. But I think that it needs to be qualified in the bill. It must say so. It must be very, very clear that exactly what you are talking about. Finally, and I want to keep this brief, in reference to issues of exemptions, you've actually helped us understand that. I think there was a lot of misconception. That you said it refers specifically to SANDFN SAPs, and I can understand we would not want to compromise the status of our operations, neither do we want to compromise the lives of our operators. I understand that fully well. My concern there is, but I would raise that concern after clarification. What is the case currently? I mean, you know, we're extensively involved in peace support operations outside Burundi and elsewhere. Are you saying to us that when we go on peace support operations, that the type of equipment that we take, or whatever we take with us to fulfill that responsibility and role, has to come via a permit that is issued? Is that the case? All right. Do you not see or find any loophole in the system, in this exemption, whereby, now I hope I'm not exaggerating this. Let me, by way of illustration, explain this. Let's say that someone has an interest in supplying a 2000 AK-47s. I don't want to make it into a joke by saying Zimbabwe. Let's say somebody covertly wants to do that. And they come up with a lovely, beautiful plan that they make an application from an internal person assisting them, makes an application to say, we have an operation going, we require 500 or 600 AK-47s. So it may not be AK, I'm just giving an example. What is there in this system to ensure that doesn't happen, that under the guise of special ops or something, that this weapon reached that destination without anybody knowing it, and we cannot have oversight over that? Is there anything here that can actually ensure that doesn't happen? I know it sounds silly, but actually funny things happen. Thank you.
For your information, then, in the staff for your information, as we carry R5 and R3 in our country, in Zimbabwe, it's AK-47. Dr. Colin of Kennedy Alley.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in last week you kept on saying no company can be able to take out control items outside of the country. Now, I'm taking that. I'm not saying it can or it is, but I'm saying, how possible is that? With all the security holes in the net, and I'm relating that with the EUC. I understand that, what you have just explained, but how are you going to be able to keep up with the EUC? Because you have challenges of human resource challenges. Vis-a-vis the EUC and what you said, I'm just trying to balance that. You've got your airports that are not mended security-wise. How are you going to be able to know that these control items do get out of the country or do, in fact, come into the country? Because you said yourself, there are private companies that purchase some of these control items. Within South Africa, they can also be able to take these control items out of the country because there are these challenges. That's for one check. I just wanted to check with all the elaborated explanation that we were given on officiating the scrutiny committee. I just want to get why in the first place did you opted for it to be legislated vis-a-vis now, because you are now saying you are realizing that it could be in the regulation. Why in the first place you wanted to legislate it? With all what has been said about the scrutiny commission, and how do you envisage now to deal with the time frames? Because you are saying in the committee, you said that the scrutiny committee has been in work. It has been working for all this time, but also we are saying there were limitations in that because the committee on what is allowed applying in the principal act is the time frame that the committee must be for a period of time and do its work and be dissolved and all of that. But also you made the mention of committees, or if I got that correctly, that there were supposed to be ministers in that committee. And how are you going to be able to deal with that now? Why was it a problem before for ministers to be in that committee? And also, there was a main mention to the fact that there should be professionals in this scrutiny committee. People who know what they are dealing with in terms of the defense-related issues. Have you considered that? And lastly, Chair, I just want to understand. Mr. Lala has said, now, whatever information they are giving to you, they will give to Parliament the same information, detailed information. But in the same breath, he cautions us about the confidentiality and all the other things that may be challenging. But what about all the publications of this information, the website and all that people out there who get this information, and yet you are saying must be cautious of the confidentiality? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Koranov.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to Mr. Tatler for the comprehensive briefing that we've received this morning. Just one or two questions or comments. The first one is the scrutiny committee. If I remember correctly, the AG concern originally is one of the emphasis of matter in the annual report published by the Auditor General. One of his emphasis of matter is the NCACC. Just correct me if I'm wrong. And one of the issues there, he said, was what you mentioned, the constitution of a committee. He required a constitution of the committee. Now, I don't know whether he required a constitution of the NCACC or a constitution of the scrutiny committee or the subcommittee, as it stands in the current Act, Clause 7. Why didn't you consider that option, to go the constitution route? Because, unfortunately, I don't have the AG report here with me, but he said one of the qualifications was a lack of a constitution for the committee. Why didn't you consider to draft a constitution and address the concern of the Auditor General in that way? Secondly, if I go to the original Act, well, you said the committee is a political committee. It consists of politicians. The subcommittee currently, all the subcommittees potentially will consist of politicians. Why didn't you consider, instead of legalizing a scrutiny committee, to amend Section 7 and make it not time-bound? You mentioned that as a possibility. So I'm putting that as a second option. Why didn't you draft a constitution as was required by qualification of the Auditor General? Alternatively, why do you not consider to amend clause, existing clause 7, to make it not time bound? Because if I look at the existing 7, it says ministers may be appointed to the subcommittees, but the committee may also appoint people not in the full-time employment of the state and pay such allowances and remunerations. So that is my question, whether we have not considered those two options instead of going to the existing new establishment of recruitment. The reason why I say this, the way I read it as I read the new 7A, it gives the impression that you transfer or you delegate also political responsibility. Because this committee only consists of DGs. And if you look at the functions of the committee, on Section 4, it's all about the control items. Section 14 is all about all the various permits. And Section 11 is to do about regulations in or any other power or duty referred to this committee. And then on the meetings, this committee, it seems, may determine their own way of working, their meeting schedules, their own procedures. The impression it's created in the amendment, it's a vast major power and authority being provided to this scrutiny committee. And this is maybe where the uneasiness comes in, that you transfer responsibility and you transfer such an open-ended responsibility that people start, like in the hearings, start to ask questions. So that is my first one on the scrutiny committee. Secondly, on the reports, I really would like to thank Mr. Dladla that we changed the heading back to disclosures and non-disclosures. It's just more fitting than only about reports, because the intention of the original existing act is disclosure and non-disclosure and not about reports. I would just argue, and the questions have been asked, I'm not going to repeat it, why the whole issue of the act, the central core of the act, that the NCACC must report to Parliament. That's the bottom line. And currently we get the impression, as it stands now, the reporting is downscaled by, for instance, taking away quarterly reports to Parliament. Now, there is a history, because we haven't received quarterly reports, as Dr. Schumann has said, and we haven't received annual reports on time. So there is a little bit of a history that is not, doesn't make good reading. And now we say, when I look at all the submissions, the impression they create is there's a downscaling on reporting of the NCAC, not only to Parliament, but also to the committee. And I think we must address that myth or perception quite seriously on the reports. I agree with Mr. Dladla that I think, and that's my personal view, that I think you're correct in the sense that no piece of information, no committee, no body must hold any secret or sensitive information to Parliament. I think Parliament has the powers to obtain, to request any secret documents or sensitive document to be provided. And then it's a matter of how do we go about that? What is the relationship between the NCACC and the Parliament? I'm talking to the Portfolio Committee now. How do you deal with that sensitive information? It has happened in the past. When Professor Asmal was chair of the NCACC, this committee did deal with very sensitive secret information. And I just want to make sure that this still the intention of the NCACC, if the Parliamentary Committee on Defense requests secret information and sensitive information, that you will not have a problem to provide that information in an open and a transparent way. What we have to find is a fine balance between giving that secret information also in the public domain. And I think that, I'm asking you, what is your practical solution to adhere to the central core of the Act, namely to report to the public, versus the sensitive information reported to the Portfolio Committee? That's my second question. The third one, I'm very concerned, Comrade says, that the whole issue of staffing of the NCACC is being dealt in the report that we've received here this morning about a procedural issue. I think it's more important than that. I think we need to ask the NCACC, if you have a staffing problem or a remuneration problem, that you do talk to the committee to say there is a staffing problem and we need capacity. Because when we met with you on the 15th of May, we asked you specifically, because there were concerns raised about the time frames the NCAC takes to make a judgment or give an answer for each of the permits they issue. And you gave this committee very much detail for each permit, how long it takes you. So when you talk about, or the people that presented last week talk about the regularity of the meetings and being cancelled, it is just as serious as keeping to the time frames of reporting to the various permits. So I would like you to address the committee on your capacity, keeping to the time frames, keeping to your meeting schedules, keeping to the time frames about making decisions on the various permits. Because out there, in the industry, time is money. And when you lose time, a day, a week, 2 weeks, it costs the country, it costs the industry a lot of money. So I need you to unpack the staffing issue. And for me, it's not only administrative or procedural. So for me, it's to the very core of your functioning, that you are properly staffed, properly equipped, properly remunerated, and then it probably relates to the scrutiny committee. My last question, do I understand you correctly that the prohibition of mercenary act is not, the words you used was, it's not active at the moment? I can't remember what exact words you said. Let me check here. I can't find it, but you said it's waiting for regulations or it's not being implemented at the moment. I just need to find clarity on that, because this act was promulgated by this committee in 2006. It was signed by the President in 2007. We're now in 2008. I just want to make sure whether that act is active and being implemented at the moment. If you could just clarify that. And then the last remark that you made, that she, I think you want to park it for later discussion, the division of power between the Minister of Defence and the chair of the NCACC. That was your very last paragraph, but it's a crucial paragraph. It doesn't only relate to that paragraph that this submission referred to. I think it was the Defence Industry, AMD. What you address in that last paragraph 40 of your submission is the whether the minister or the chairperson is applicable. I think it, just clarify for me, it doesn't refer to that specific clause. It is to do with the whole operation of the NCACC versus the Department of Defence. Thank you, Chair.
Daniel, you'll be the last day of the chance.
Unfortunately, Chair, my question has been taken. But let me go around once. Kelebuka and Morena Zas, you had a lengthy presentation this morning. I would like to find out or know, with regard to auditing, you in the process said that things, or like for instance, weaponry media and finances are constantly audited. Now, I would like to know how many times per year the auditing is taking place. Again, after the auditing, the results are sent to the NCC committee. And so I would like to know about that. Thank you very much.
Two last things, the organizational and personal implications. If you look very closely into it, you said the bill does not have any organizational and personal implications. And you continue to then say that the existing structures of the Department of Defense and the NCC will manage the implementation of these amendments. If you can elaborate on that, because as we deliberate and talking about the scrutiny committee being put into place, well, what implications does it really have? Because this particular statement, I'll simply say it could be, I'm not sure, but depending on your explanation, could be defeating what the bill is intending to do in establishing this particular committee. Then the financial implications, it tends to be a worry. Whenever we receive bills that would come and then say the amendment of the Act will have no financial implications, if you can also talk much into that. But some of the questions that have been asked by members, I actually want to make a very strong emphasis that there is absolutely nothing that cannot be disclosed to Parliament. Absolutely nothing. Everything, if we call for anything to be disclosed before Parliament, must be disclosed. But now it's dependent on the how part. We were a bit uncomfortable, last week, but one, when we could sense that the honourable ministers were in a way conflicting themselves in one way or the other. But the truth of the matter is that nothing escapes Parliament. Cabinet accounts to Parliament, and not Parliament accounting to Cabinet. Whatever Cabinet does is per the dictates of Parliament and the public outside. So I think, Dr. Kolonoff, we are very clear on that one. But we'll hear from them. But the truth of the matter is, as you are agreeing with me, is that it's a how part. We have to look into that. We have to look into that. We look into that particular area because it has created some kind of a discomfort within the committee. That is why even the other presenters, you think that they took everything away from us when they began to talk on our behalf when they presented the question of you not submitting reports in time to Parliament. I think you heard them saying last week. Truly and indeed, these are part of the areas that we have to look into. As much as members also said, this question of quarterly reports, Dr. Kolonoff and Dr. Schumann have touched on that one. Because the big question now arises to then say, if you then say we have to do away, we have to be convincing. If you say we have to do away with that and agree with yourself as you are proposing, but you haven't tabled any report before when we talk about a quarterly report. Yes, we have been listening to you to then say it could be quite cumbersome, a question of the capacity and what have you. But one would be sympathetic if there were reports coming through. But in my understanding, there were no quarterly reports that were submitted before Parliament. I want to allow you to also talk to that, so that we, yeah, let me hand over to you.
I just want to come in on this issue of the information that must come before Parliament. I think the department, through the minister last week, did concede that actually there is nothing that the department cannot bring forward to Parliament that Parliament is asking for. Even this morning, I think, and Mr. Glanda mentioned that the department will provide the Parliament with any information that they may ask for. The fact that the report has come in a manner in which it came is because we were being guided by what is contained in legislation as of now. But we are amenable as a department to say we may change or amend the legislation to suit the imperatives of Parliament. If Parliament says this is what they need to be included in the report, it is not upon the department to come and say to Parliament, no, we cannot put that in the report. The minister was here and he informed the House or the members here that we just need to come up with maybe a new format of how we should be reporting to Parliament in future. We are ready as a department to provide any information that may be required. And then on the other issues, I think Mr. Zigela and Mr. Gaza will address.
Just before then, we have to allow them, Mr. Shah, so that they can talk to that. I don't know, you are in your hand. Yeah.
Chair, I heard, I didn't get your name, Madam. You said, what you're saying still is not satisfactory. What you're saying to us here today is that your department will be willing to supply information as per required by Parliament. Whatever Parliament requires, that information we will give. Now, why will Parliament require information from you or write to you for information when you haven't told them everything that they need to know? Now, sounds silly. But if we don't get, for example, suppose you gave a permit to sell 3 helicopters to a country. If you don't put it in your report and don't tell us how many and to who and for how much, we're not going to require that information from you because we don't know it. So perhaps it's very important to know that point. What information Parliament will require, we are willing to give. We are saying to you, without requisite, without us asking you, it's your responsibility to tell us what you have done. That point needs to be noted.
If I may, I don't want to labor much on this, but it is important. Here, the legislation does not, we pass the legislation, we cannot constrain ourselves and then say, having passed the legislation, then say, we don't want that information. The legislation refers to other structures that would be needing that kind of information. We have legislated on that. I can't find ourselves coming up with a legislation and then say, this is yours, we don't need it, keep it to yourself. The legislation does not say so. It is the interpretation of the legislation that is important, because once it's with yourself, I want to repeat myself. Cabinet accounts to Parliament and we pass legislation. If we talk about disclosure, we are referring to then say, because we legislate, what is critical is that when you come before Parliament, we agree on this. We have to have all the information, irrespective.
but it's the how part. It's the how part. Because we as parliament, we are just as responsible. So I'm then saying, when we get into the interpretation of the legislation, let's not find a way to then say they were restraining clauses that might not have allowed the department to disclose to parliament. I think the minister also referred to that. I keep on hearing you referring to the minister. The minister was also accounting to us, so he was quite clear of what we were talking about, because he's accounting to parliament. So what I'm then saying is, it's important that we look into this and understand that we legislated, and we cannot at any given time restrain ourselves when we do legislate and say certain things must not come to parliament. The reason I'm saying this, honorable, it's what the department provided to parliament or to this particular committee as to what you disclose to the United Nations. It was, in fact, that really caused us to be very much uncomfortable. That's the area that we're talking about to then say, let's look into that and begin to address that. Both ministers, that is the deputy chair, they agreed to that, which I think now we have reached a point to then say, let's address that. Once again, he is now putting the modalities and the how we're going to do that. That is why in our last meeting, we're then saying, how are we going to begin to formulate the reports that are going to be tabled? That is the confidential and non-confidential. Because the public outside, they have entrusted us with this kind of a responsibility. If we know that information, the public outside, they do believe. And when we communicate and when we debate, they would understand. Because they believe in us, including yourself. Over to you.
Chairperson, I thought we were really in agreement on the issue, even from last week. We had, in a way, come to a consensus that there is need to elaborate more on the report that was before you. And as you put it, the how part of it was what was outstanding. Then going forward, we need to look at the how part of it. It was also made an example, or the example of the report from the UN was used to say, maybe that is the same format that we might have to use in reporting to Parliament. So what is outstanding, in my understanding, is how do we do it going forward? The other issues, we seem to have come to a consensus.
Okay. The next question.
Mr. Chairperson, I think one of the difficult things that we have is the history that we have behind us. And I think that we find that some of the proposals are just against the history that we have. But the intent of the NC is to actually break into new ground. I think we have had some period where there was discomfort. And I think we want to create a dispensation where all the relevant parties are actually comfortable with the machinery that we're driving. I'm saying so, Chairperson, because you see, the NCCC as an institution, or rather the law that we implement, if you were to compare it to other countries in the region or in Africa, I think it's one of the best in the developing world, even if you go beyond Africa. So this is an institution that is important, and all that we have to try now is to actually oil these wheels, which may start to creep from where here and there. And obviously, then, with the history that we have is not the best you could find. However, we would want to break away from that, and the reporting is essentially that. But I'll give over to my colleague, Mr. Jigela, to address the first concerns that have been, the first questions asked by Dr. Tuscan.
Mr. Jigela. Thank you, Bob.
Just
Thank you very much. I'll just answer the question that was raised by Dr. Kumar with regard to the scrutiny committee. Chair, it is correct to say that Section 11 of the Act as it stands empowers the committee and the minister to delegate certain powers to the subcommittee, to the secretariat, and to the inspectorate. But I think maybe it's exactly the point that Mr. Dada was making, that sometimes in doing the things that we do, there is always the color of the history that we have. That always comes up. Because although there is such a delegation, from a practical point of view, there has always been a concern to say, given the level at which the NCACC is pitched, is it practically possible to get people at that level to be able to do the kind of stuff work that the scrutiny committee is intended to do? And I think that same issue touches on the question that Dr. Gordon has also raised, that why didn't we consider the possibility of amending that section to empower those subcommittees to do the kind of work? But I think there is a practical side to it, that if a committee is pitched at that level, can those people really be bogged down by the kind of detail that Mr. Landa was giving to the committee last week, compiling all those minutes and all those kind of things? So that is the practical side against which we've been planning up to the point that we decided to legislate. And indeed, the issue of the Constitution was considered, as it was raised. But the issue was, given the nature of the work that is intended to be done by the committee, even if you were to draft the Constitution, what is the legislative basis for that Constitution and for them to discharge the functions that they would be discharging? That question would always be there. We could have done an internal thing which has no legislative or statutory basis. But I think someone at some stage could say, on what basis, legislative basis, because the law does not make any provision for any other kind of committee to do that work other than the NCACC itself. But that the work that the scrutiny committee does should be distinguished from what the secretariat does. That is Mr. Lama. I think last year the point that Mr. Lama tried to make was to say the establishment of the NCACC itself was informed by the concern to say the work that the NCACC does cannot be done by the land functions department or the department in the security sector. Now the question is, even if you were to want to give that kind of work to the land function, which is the secretariat, the concern that you will have, can the secretariat, being administratively located within a line function department, be entrusted with the kind of work that is scrutiny done currently? So there is that concern, even if you were to build the capacity within the secretariat itself. But the concern will still be, if you take into consideration the motive behind the NCACC itself, would you want to entrust that function to a single department as opposed to the whole other departments that are participating? So there are all those kind of nuances that really one has to consider. Again, I'm coming back to the color of the history that we have here. There are a number of possibilities, the issue of the Constitution, the issue of amending Section 7 itself. But I think there was a structure which, in the view of the department and the NCACC, was doing excellent work for the committee. So it made sense at the time to legislate around that kind of structure. Not that there are no other possibilities, like Mr. Dada indicated. It could be done within the context of the regulations, but you will still need to put in an empowering provision in Section 7 for the establishment of the scrutiny by means of regulation, because regulation is nothing but a delegated legislation. So there has to be something that empowers the minister or the chairperson of the NCAC to establish that committee at that level. I hope, Chair, I've been able to just briefly touch on some of the issues. If there is anything that I leave out, I think my colleague will add to those issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
I think, Chair President, just to qualify, well, not qualify, but add to what my colleague is saying, I think to us, at the bottom line, we are saying we are just, all that we're calling for is a formalization of a committee that can do this kind of work, whether it's done at the level of the law or at the level of regulation. We are not necessarily opposed to any of the options. But as my colleague has said, maybe given the fact that there is an impression that has been given, I think there has been statement made by Dr. Korenoff and Dr. Skuman that the impression that is created is that then the scrutiny committee seems to assume responsibilities that the NCECC has in terms of the law. And the intention is totally not to do that. And maybe then just to eliminate that particular impression, I think one of the options, therefore, is to go that route of actually amending Section 7 and just eliminate the time-bound, the time aspect that is related to that, as well as address the issue of the minister or a member of the NCECC sitting there, because currently that is the limitation that the scrutiny committee has to operate under Section 7 of the committee, of the Act. And I think we are just saying to us those are options that need to be considered. But we accept entirely that obviously from where Parliament is standing currently, I think that impression, I think it's legitimate for Parliament to have such a concern. And I think that it is in light of that we are therefore saying we can consider the possibility of looking at Section 7 so that we can have a formalization of, we may not call it a committee, call it a subcommittee that does the following task and eliminate this monster that is rising possibly over the NCECC. The other question that Dr. Schoeman had asked earlier is the whole issues of financial implications of the legislation vis-a-vis the provision of the CAD memo or the explanatory memorandum that it said there are no financial implications for this. Maybe there was some element of oversight insofar as that is concerned. I think one needs to be able to concede to that. But when we came with the chairperson of the NCECC in May, we indicated the issue of capacity. And I think the capacity issue with the Secretariat is there, was even there before these amendments were actually thought of. So that is why we had therefore said at the time that we are therefore investigating possibilities of increasing the capacity of the Secretariat in a manner that will allow the NCECC to deliver on all its standing obligations. It may be on reports, it may be on whatever kind of obligation that we have. And I think therefore, because the truth of the matter is, the NCECC's capacity is largely resident in the Secretariat, because that is where a lot of the paperwork is actually done. And the more you create capacity there, therefore, the work of the NCECC can be facilitated. We accept, Chairperson, that there are implications. But we're saying those implications were even there before this bill was actually introduced. But it's an inevitable reality of this business. You've got to be able to increase the capacity in a manner that makes the NCECC to deliver on its standing mandate. Mr. Shah posed quite a number of questions, and I think I'll answer some of them, and I'll ask Jira to answer some of the questions as we proceed. And I think I've already dealt with the issue of capacity to say the capacity of the NCECC is largely informed by the capacity of the Secretariat. To increase capacity there, you therefore may have an improved NCECC capacity. I think that is our view. But we are therefore saying issues of capacities, I think those are matters that are not necessarily, I don't think that those are matters that you can say in the Act that there shall be an increased capacity in the Secretariat. I think the section under Secretariat is sufficient. It says there shall be a Secretariat. Then I think the issue of the quantity, the numbers that you have and all of that, it is a matter of implementation other than the matter of law, as it were. It's an administrative process. But obviously, to give effect to the intent of the Act, and I think we do not want to depart from that. And I think the second issue is asked, why legislate for this thing as opposed to delegating? And obviously, the scrutiny committee operates under delegation at present. It's called delegation. But obviously, there are these concerns that the delegation is there, but then the delegation is such that it's to a subcommittee that is not time-bound. And therefore, you've got this legislative challenge insofar as that is concerned. So that is why, therefore, we have opted for the route of going legislation. But as I said, we can consider any other formalization of it other than putting it in the legislation. Obviously, we accept that the impression may be created of this particular institution being created, therefore taking away the powers of the NCCC. Mr. Schaffner's question was around the disclosure and non-disclosure of information. To say, my colleague here, Ms. Kubushi, has indicated that. I think what Parliament requires from the Department should not be at the request of Parliament. And I think there should be just a standing obligation of the institution to provide. And I think that for Section 23 seeks to do that, to say there shall be a requirement for the NCCC to report at this predetermined time. And therefore, such information must therefore be presented. However, between the reporting times as provided here, the NCCC, or the committee here, the portfolio committee, has got the right to call the department or the NCCC to account on any matter over and above the reporting. I think the issue of the recent accounting by the chairperson and myself on the issue of Zimbabwe was a classic example of that. It's to say you can be called at any time and you must lay your facts bare to the inquiry. But our view is the reconciliation has got to be found between the UN report, where we are therefore providing detailed information. But his question, Mr. Shah, is, if you're talking about confidentiality clause, what do they actually stick to? Practically, I think the limited exposure to the thing that I have, it actually says, in any particular region, you find that there will be competition between neighbors on what kind of equipment do they have and this and that and that. But I think the confidentiality here is normally that it is largely about the kind of equipment that we therefore provide. If country X with an X and Y are fitted together, X may not know that Y has got attack helicopters which are called Gripen, or the other one has got a Roy Falk attack helicopter. But in terms of reporting, I think you may actually accommodate that concern by actually saying, insofar as that is concerned, you may therefore report on the category, being category A to X and Y. You therefore don't go down to the specific technical specification of those, so that you therefore may therefore interfere with the security concerns of those countries. But I think the point is, we do not have to Parliament, we have to come forward and say, country X and Y have got certain concerns, but what they are buying is the following, in finer detail to the last screw that you can actually find. However, we'll therefore say to Parliament, there has been a concern about full disclosure of the information, and therefore, together decide how best to still remain obedient to the reporting requirements of the Act, but also taking into account the security interests that may be applicable at that given time. So, but to Parliament, we'll come with that whole information. We will not say, this is confidentiality, limited information, it will not come to Parliament. I think that is not generally the intention. And I think, therefore, it's just to work out the detail that actually addresses that particular thing in the manner that I've tried to express. And the other issue was also, I think, around the issue of reports to the UN. I think information at UN should be consistent with them. And, in fact, it should be even much more detailed in the case of Parliament, because UN requires a report on 7 categories. What we need to provide here, we need to provide something more than that. Something like services, something like small arms, which are not part of that, and all of it. So I think the report here needs to be even much more comprehensive than UN, because there are 7 categories. We need to provide 7 categories here, and even more than that. And I think that is the view that we have on this particular aspect. The other point was by Mr. Shah is the transfer, to say, well, he understands what you're saying about transfer, but as I said earlier, that we would qualify the definition of transfer to say it's only applicable in instances where the title changes hands. I think we'll just qualify it. I think we'll do that. This is your advisor and subject that to the approval of the committee. The other point was by Mr. Shah is the loophole of operations. To say in cases where you give a permit to the SNDF to deploy in the DRC, as an example, is the permit that they have, if it says 20 rattles, 20 this, 20 that, do they export the 20 as the numbers as indicated, or they therefore start to put in other things which are not part of that? I think as the NCCC, we are moving from the basis that we have got institutions of government that have got a particular mandate, and trust that they would not do so. because at the time of export, what therefore happens at the port of entry or port of exit, it is that there is therefore a custom stamp that actually says there were actually 20, 30 of this and that going out. So we therefore think that that is a good enough mechanism to actually ensure that what was exported was indeed that which was authorized. And we also trust these institutions as institutions of government, of institutions of state, to execute particular mandate. And we would not doubt their integrity insofar as that is concerned. But we have this mechanism to actually double check. And if there is a departure, and that departure between what has been exported and what has was authorized should actually be actually explained in full detail. The next question that we asked were asked by Honorable Daniels, and I'll deal with them. The first one was related to EUCs. To say, if we're talking about EUCs and you're saying there will be exemptions that we are proposing in the manner that we do, what kind of capacity do we have to actually verify that people do not take us for a ride under the guise of the exemption? And I think that is how I understand that. How you work with these exemptions is that you will therefore, before you can issue an exemption, you must therefore, I think that is detail that you should provide in the regulations. You must therefore say that will be the factors to be considered by the NCECC before they can issue an exemption, because the exemption should not be arbitrary to say, yes, you've got it, you don't have. But it's to say, before the NCECC can issue an exemption on the EUCs, these are the factors to consider. And to us, some of those factors are, we have to look at the strength of the arms control system where you are exporting to. Who is the end user? What is the status of the arms control system that is there? What are the companies that are involved? And therefore, there could be much more than that. And therefore, on the basis of that, you therefore decide. But once you have granted the exemption, you want therefore to know whether that exemption was exercised in a manner that it was given. And I say, if therefore you want to check whether that component part went to some other country, we can still do that. But already, what we have, the inspectorate does what is called international inspection, where on instruction by the NCECC, depending on the nature of whatever matter, they therefore instruct the inspectorate to go to a particular country and verify if the country that is there is still compliant with its undertaking as made at whatever point in time. And there is a report that therefore comes back, which is therefore tabled before the NCECC. And if there is a departure from the undertaking, therefore the NCECC can engage the government of the country through foreign affairs and see how best to actually hold them to account. But I think the capacity is there. But the question is, as the industry is growing, the reality is that as the industry is growing, and I think if you want to regulate them, you must therefore correspondingly increase the capacity that you have with the NCECC to catch up with that. Otherwise, you may have all these powers, but you don't have powers or capacity to execute. And I think you are as bad as not having the law. So we accept that. That is why, therefore, we come back to the whole point raised by Dr. Skuman earlier, that capacity is important. And I think it was oversight to us not to even indicate in the explanatory memorandum that there shall be implications. There will be those implications if these amendments are to be provided. I think that the next question that she asked was related to scrutiny committee. I think we've tried to deal with that. As I said, to repeat that, we are amenable to actually going the route of having Section 7 amended to eliminate the time as well as the task factor there, and be able therefore to deal with it in the regulations. But on the issue of experts, to say who serves the development experts and this and that and that, as proposed by the Catholic officials, they said that they would want to. Somebody even said you can even serve on the committee. But I think it's a matter that one has to, as the delegation of powers or the subcommittee section, it says the NCECC or the minister can actually employ any person that it feels that has got competence to serve in a committee. And I think that provision is there already. So So all that needs to be done is to have that section exercised if there is a need to do so. I think there is that already. I think I had dealt with the issue of confidentiality clause to say the limitations there are as good as, but such confidentiality will not be applicable to the committee or to parliament. I think they just could be applicable to reports going outside as public. And I even said last week that we could have in Defense Department where I normally see that they've got what is called public report as well as the other report. Maybe we can therefore also look at that as a way of getting around that. Dr. Korenov, I thought that I'll give all things together, but I want to address this because it's a matter that it's specific. That the AG report was actually talking to the constitution of the NCCC, not putting the committee. What they were actually saying, well, in our interpretation of that, obviously it says NCCC, but in our engagement with them, what they had said, and what they call management report, because you know that what the Auditor General does, it does a lot of audit, and it produces a comprehensive report on what they found. And therefore they apply what they call materiality test, where they therefore say what aspects here are of such a nature and material that they need to go to reporting. And therefore, they therefore put that of the NCCC there. But in the management report that they've complied, they had therefore questioned all these kinds of things. So it was, now it might not have gone to the level of being public. But if you look at the management report that the Secretariat has, and that provides much more detail. And I think that has been referred to over and over again. But I think we have addressed the issue again as to how we would want to deal with that in relation to the amendment of Section 7. There was an issue asked, I think, on the impression. I think we have addressed the issue of impression. There's the issue of reports, and an impression has been created that we want to downscale the reporting obligations of the NCCC. And I think that could be the impression, but I think the intent of the NCCC is contrary to that particular intention. The intention here, I think, as I said, we want to move into a new ground, where we are not seen as hiding any information, because I understand where I stand. You get contact from NGOs, and they look at this as an institution shrouded in secrecy and all of it. And I think we want to move away from that. We want to move away from that particular perception. And that is why then we're saying, on the Section 23, I think we need to be very careful in providing the detail that will be provided so that we move away from that particular perception that is dealt with. And a classification of information, whether information is secret and all of it. I can say now, history has said all the records of the NCCC has been classified secret. And I agree that I think that was taking the matter too far. Because some of this information, when you look at it, depending where you stand, you may not make sense of it. You may not. Category A, if you don't know what category A is, you are still in the dark. So I think the classification of information is an issue that I think we need to deal with in a manner that we classify information without necessarily denying people's access to that or parliament access to that. And I think it's an issue of confidentiality to us. It's not secret information. It's information that could be confidential depending on the audience that you have.
You remind me of Madiba when he met with de Klerk, and they said they had a secret meeting. Madiba said, he said, no, it was just confidential.
I'm glad to have used a word of the statement of that standing. The staffing, and I think we are back to that. I think the staffing of the secretary, that is Dr. Korenov has asked, is very critical. Because that is the engine what makes the NCCC tick. Details of the staffing. I think the reality is we currently sit with a staff capacity of about 11 people. And I indicated last week that the industry, at the time when the structure was created in 96 or so, you had about 200 companies registered. And I think it was convenient, it was appropriate to have that capacity and all of that. But we have since had the the industry, the numbers of companies registered to 800 odd and counting. But the capacity has remained 11. So I think what we are doing now through the departmental processes is to actually upscale the capacity to be consistent with the number or the size of the industry. And I think, therefore, we accept that currently the capacity is a problem. I think we should have indicated it here, but it was because we thought that it's a matter that was there even before this amendment was contemplated. Prohibition of Mercenary Activities Act. Let me just confirm that this act is currently not in force. Was not in operation. That's the right language to use. Meaning it's not being implemented. The reason for that is that is a regulation. Because if you were to implement today, say you want to implement this act, what you're going to run into is that you won't have regulations that will therefore make you to be able to implement it. If it says in the prescribed, you must apply in a prescribed format and all of, so those formats are being worked out now. So you can't therefore put it into operation without necessarily bringing up the necessary documentation that needs to come with that. I think, Jefferson, on the issue of division of power between the minister and the chair, I think maybe, as you said, you'd want to deal with that. We'd want to deal with that later. But to us, it's a very important matter because it speaks to the objectivity some other time of the secretariat. How objective can you be if you find yourself operating under certain circumstances? And I think it's a matter that, but we said, the use of minister and the use of the chairperson is dictated in the legis or in the proposal or in the bill by the context within which it is used. Mr. Diale had asked the question, how frequent are these audits that are being conducted? The truth of the matter is that I think we try to, the inspectorate is trying to attend to as much, but the inspectorate is being also upscaled in terms of capacity. But at present, I think they are not. Well, I know that in audit terms, you need to audit once a year. I don't think they have been able to do so on all companies once a year. And I think the intention is to come to that level where every company will be subject to an audit at least once a year. It could be more than that, but at the very bare minimum, it should be once a year. Jefferson, I think you had asked questions about implications of HR finance as well as HR. I think I've already addressed those. And I think this is our response.
Thank you, Chair. I'm glad. I'm sure Mr. Dadla is quite mentally fatigued and tired to respond to all the questions which might
seem quite unnecessary. Sometimes you might feel, what's wrong with this committee? Don't they understand? Well, Chair, I'm glad he answered some of my questions, but I still want to revisit and go back to the question of disclosure. He did attempt to answer the question by saying, and I'm glad he did say that that everything should be accessible to us, that nothing confidential should be kept away from Parliament. But I still, we have seen reports previously and they were not, and that's why you say our minds are clouded with what was happening in the past, right? Even the 2007 report. There's nothing in there that says that this information in relation to country A, B, or C was subjected to a confidentiality clause. However, we're making this information available to public. It's not there, right? Now, when you sign, when a defense company signs a contract with another country, another company, and there is a confidentiality clause, non-disclosure, we're not going to disclose this information, that is a legally binding document, right? The only way you can make that information available to the House or to Parliament is if that contract in itself states so, that we're going to exempt Parliament from this. That the Parliament of RSA will be exempted from this contract of non-disclosure, for example. Because if you give that information to us, having signed that confidentiality clause, which was done in the sales contract, you're in violation of that one, and that country, for example, or the first client that purchased that particular equipment, can they not hold you legally responsible for that? So, while you express your rightful sentiment that nothing will be kept from Parliament, and that you will inform us, but would you not be in violation of that clause, that confidentiality clause? That's the question I have for you on that matter. Secondly, on the issue of the anti-mercenary bill, what you're saying to us is that we passed this bill in 2006, right? 2006, 2007, 2008. Now through this bill, we are going to give the necessary tools for implementing a bill that we passed in 2006. So now, did we do something wrong? This is the question. Did we do something wrong now that a bill that was passed by us in 2006 could not be implemented and operationalized? Now we need new regulations to actually give effect to a bill that we passed in 2006. Did we put the horse before the cart? And what went wrong? Was that bill deficient? Did we miss something here? Thank you.
Let me take Dr. Kolanov and then Dr. Skoman.
Okay, very, very briefly. If we talk about, if you suggest that you may consider the amendment of Section 7 instead of the scrutiny committee, what would you propose on the composition, the functions, and meetings of that? You're not going to transfer the scrutiny committee to composition. Just unpack for me, what do we mean then about the composition of that subcommittee if we amend it? What will be the functions? Are we going to be more specific on the functions of this committee and the meeting procedures? I'm referring now to the current amendment, 7A, 7B, and 7C of the scrutiny committee. If we go the route of amending Section 7, take away the time frame of the subcommittee, I'm asking what is the composition going to be of the subcommittee, the functions, and the meeting procedures? That's my first question. Secondly, I think we've made progress with regard to Section 23. But maybe I missed it. Do you suggest give us the assurance that you will continue with the quarterly report and bring it back? I can't remember that we've discussed it. Maybe I missed that point. And then lastly, the prohibition of Mercenaries Act, not in operation or not implemented, the regulations holding it back. Can you just, what regulations, is that the regulations within the provision of Mercenaries Act, or are we talking other regulations? And 2 years after we passed the bill, who is responsible for compiling those regulations? If I can just get the number, rank, and name of that person, I'll be very happy. Thank you. Jim, my question relates to what Dr. Kornhoff just asked. Now, that's a valid issue about quarterly reports. I think we would like a compelling reason why quarterly reports must be done away with. This committee hasn't been receiving quarterly reports. The annual reports have come late. So the fact that you were compiling quarterly reports, and that's why annual reports have come late, and in some cases very late, there's no reason. There's no motivation for that. And I would like to swing the argument around, and that is, if quarterly reports are compiled, it will be so much easier to furnish us with annual reports in time. And it's actually going to assist the committee, your committee and this committee, in obtaining information. And I would also like to express my appreciation. I think we're making vast progress concerning the whole issue of transparency, the
the amount of information which will be furnished, the quality of that information, etc., etc. Then we are moving forward. But this issue of doing away with the quarterly reports, I think, is we have no clarity and there's no compelling reason for us to accede to this request to do away with the quarterly reports. Thank you, Chair.
Dr. Koronoff, I think there's a limitation clause. We cannot disclose the... on a serious note, indeed, I think they won't be able to respond to that one. For us is to take it up with the political head. We'll have to take the matter with the political head because it's the driver thereof. We are raising this as a concern and we have to take that concern up. We can't find ourselves taking that concern with ourselves. If you may respond to the interventions made by members.
Thank you very much. I just want to deal with two questions, and then the Mr. Lander from the NCC that will answer. I just want to deal briefly, Chair, with the issue of confidentiality again, which Mr. Shah has raised again. I think, Chair, you have put it quite crisply earlier on that we cannot withhold any information from Parliament. And the Department of Defense cannot enter into any agreement or contract that will violate the Constitution. The Constitution says the executive accounts to Parliament. Any contract that will put such a kind of limitation on those responsibilities will obviously be unconstitutional. So even those kind of agreements are subject to the Constitution itself. So the Department of Defense is not in a position, not even the NCC, is in a position to contract in a manner that will exclude the rights and responsibilities under the Constitution. So I think that there is no such, in all, even international agreements that we enter into with various countries, or international bodies. We always make sure that we judge them against the responsibility that we have in terms of the Constitution. Bilateral agreements, all sorts of agreements. So there is no way that even if it were to be such a contract, it would be unconstitutional and therefore it cannot be enforced. We can insist, or parties can insist on Parliament treating information in a certain way, but we cannot say that information cannot be made available. So I think you can find comfort in that. The issue of the Mercenary Act, it is correct that the bill was passed in 2006, but the bill was only signed by the President into law in 2007. That is November 2007. You will remember, Dr. Koronoff, that it was a very contested piece of legislation. Although this House passed the bill itself, we had to deal with the President before they signed the bill into law, because there were a number of submissions that were made by some of the public members who had been with the public hearing saying the President should not sign the law. So we had to go through the same process justifying the law up until it was signed last year, November, in December. I mean, at the end, towards the end of last year. So ideally, we should have had regulations in place by today. But I think we need to accept that perhaps we've not been as diligent as we should have been. But if you look at the program of Parliament this year, not only for the Department of Defense, but for all the other departments, that are part of the task team, they have had quite a tough legislative program for the year. So I think a lot of time has been taken up by the number of bills that we had. You will remember, I have been here for the better part of this year, although I have nothing to show for it.
But you tried.
But there have been those tight schedules on all the kinds of departments that are part of that task team. So I think that's where the delay is. But the matter is getting attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll just deal with the rest of the questions. Maybe just to go back to the issue of confidentiality, you never find that the contracts that are adjudicated by the NCTC in terms of export-import may be between private entities, between a South African company with a government of some kind of country. And I think one of the clauses that they are beginning to put now is to actually make that part of their contract. If you look at the document, it's been submitted to us, that whatever they do in terms of that contract will be subject to authorization by the NCC. And I think it has been a positive development in all the contracts. And I think, therefore, all the other, whether you are private or government or state, I think the Constitution has got an overriding implication. the issue that Dr. Korinoff had asked about, let's deal with the quarterly report first, to say, what are we saying now? Because they put a proposal that says, we want to see us, we want to come to Parliament and not report quarterly, but annually. I think, just to take the committee back to last week when the minister was here, I think there was some discussion there. And there was even proposals that were not cemented later. They actually said, if there is a concern about reporting quarterly, what about reporting two times a year? And I think we therefore say, given the fact that that discussion happened, we're saying we'll therefore be advised by the committee on this issue, whether you want us to still report on a quarterly basis as well as or two times a year. But the point that was made of a motivation for quarterly reporting, now it has something to do with capacity. But at the same time, it has something to do with the nature of business. In the fact that if you look at how contracts are actually dealt with, you'll find that reporting may sometimes not be, frequent reporting may actually not necessarily give you a better position of exercising oversight. Because, for instance, how this plays itself out is that you find a company coming and say, you want to sell 20 Roifac to a country in Europe. And then they get authorized to do so. And therefore, they start to do production or whatever. And then you can find that delivery on those 20 may actually start 7 or 5 months down the line. And therefore, they come again and say, we therefore request to export 2, 3, 4 at different times. You may therefore find that frequent reporting, you can still be done, but you may therefore find that there could be a lot of overlap of information, but obviously maybe you may clarify that, but there is a possibility that it may sound like you are double reporting in certain instances. But as I said, we will be informed by the committee on how you want to move on that, and I think obviously the reporting two times a year could be a possibility. But the kind of information that is therefore provided on a quarterly basis or two times a year versus the annual report, I think you may never find that they may not necessarily be the same. I take it that even the department that I work for, I think quarterly reports are of a different format than what you see in terms of annual report, properly bound documents, pictures of the ministers and all of that. The quarterly report may be more of a, in the format that we have, just people, but obviously just allowing the committee to be able to exercise oversight. But the glossy kind of report, which we intend doing, will therefore come at the end, it will become the annual report with all the necessary photographs.
If I may once assume, you know, we've engaged with the department on the annual report. Then we then tease out in the strategy plan and business report. We then tease out some of the key issues that they had put some time frames on. Okay. Then we then said to the department, it would be appropriate that they quarterly update us on progress. Okay. That aside, will you then be persuaded? Because if you are listening to Dr. Schoeman, he was then saying, at no stage did he, as the chair of the joint, receive the quarterly report. At no given time. Would you then be persuaded if we then say, let's agree that we receive the quarterly report. But now, you are raising an issue here of saying, well, what format do they then take? Because most probably it could be repetitive. Is it going to be difficult to simply say, okay, March, April, you table your report, comprehensive quarterly, because I think the first report that you're going to provide now is going to be a bit comprehensive. Sometime in August, you then say, no, but it's still more or less the same information. Is it going to be difficult to simply say, on issues that we discussed or were contained in that particular report, these are still pending, these have been processed, these have been finalized.
even without getting into the detail thereof. Just a simple, you know, kind of a report to then say committee, because it's the committee we're going to sit and discuss, but anyway, and then say this is it. And I don't think Dr. Schumann would find it difficult when he convinces his committee to look into such, when you do present to them, say, this is the current scenario regarding the activities up to this particular quarter. Is it really going to be difficult to do that? I mean, a few lines to simply say, well, refer to the previous report, this is how far we have gone, but there's no movement here and what have you. Is it really going to be difficult to create it in that fashion?
I think it can be done. It can be done. That's what I was saying, that we need therefore just providing progress reports sometimes on some of the transactions, because they may not have been completed. They may be ongoing. We may therefore say, therefore, this transaction was signed in January. However, it is production is underway on this one, and delivery is intended to start in November, depending on the information that we have on that particular transaction. I think it can still be done. But maybe the question, therefore, that one will have to look at is whether, in the law, how do you, therefore, deal with that? To actually say, because the law may, therefore, say, provide certain information. Do you, therefore, say, well, in the case of quarterly report, you'll do it in this way, or that would be a different arrangement that is actually made?
I didn't hear your voice then,
Chair, I just want to know, How will they deal with the confidential reports when they present their report? Are they going to, you know, just to say, give a tax based on that? Because other things are secret and so on, they cannot just be revealed. Because once it's a written report in a folder and so on, it's already public. How are they going to deal with that for the committee to be informed, maybe? Because of the four committee have so made an oath that they cannot reveal any secret, but once you put it in black and white, it becomes a public document.
I'm tempted to respond to that one, because there are processes and procedures that we follow regarding a confidential report that are presented before the portfolio committee. There is a way to deal with that, even if you go to intelligence committee. There are standards set. No, I'm not. I'm going to allow them to do so. Hey, Mr. Shah.
Thank you, Chair. I hope not to belabor the point. If I may ask, can I? I said I hope I don't belabor the point. On the issue of the scrutiny committee again, I thought you might have thought we finished with it. We are still not comfortable. So I've been thinking, how is the scrutiny committee consisting of DGs from these departments going to enhance the efficiency and the capacity? As you said, that these DGs that are going to be on the scrutiny committee are not going to enhance capacity, because that comes in your secretariat from the functionaries and officials that have to actually monitor and process permits. Are we not giving political decision making in the hands of civil servants? That's a question I'm asking. Because, as we said in the beginning, functions can be delegated, yes. But to me, it would seem as though a decision taken by the scrutiny committee would, in 85 to 90% of cases, be approved by the NCACC. I have no doubt that would be the case. Now, what about the political decisions that have to be made? Because recommendations would come from here. They would have, these gentlemen, the director generals, are going to be making the decision. When it goes to cabinet, to me it seems as though the chairperson of the committee, as well as, you know, cabinet, says, listen, we don't have time for this. We are so busy. We have other responsibilities. Let's put together a few people. Let them decide. And all we need to do is to, what did the NIA say? Says, let's sign it. That's basically what I look at it as. And I think that's like dangerous, because political decisions have to be made. And if that political decision is going to be determined by agreement by all these departmental heads, for me, it's still problematic.
The time is for the first one.
we are having a sitting. We are having a sitting today. We have 2 days to labor on the same issue. That is on Tuesday and Wednesday next week. Where we target that by Wednesday. We put a smile in your face with that. I'm saying this because we still have to sit down with Mr. Shah and engage further. Because the flow up to this very moment is we're discussing and deliberating on these issues. We are reaching an understanding. So I'm then saying, it's a question of us as a committee once again sitting to begin to then say, are we understanding what we're agreeing on as a committee? Because we have raised pertinent issues that will be accommodated when you come up with your second draft on Tuesday, so that on Wednesday we are now able, I think we will be, if committee members agree, whereby now we'll be going close by close. I want on Tuesday to for us all to look into some of the issues that we are going to incorporate, on some of the issues that we have raised. And it does not then say you should not communicate with us, even telephonically. I know we normally do that. If you feel that this is a quiet understanding that is coming from the committee regarding specific issues. Also, you might as well look into part of your research that you'll be doing also on some of the issues that you're raised by the committee. We are going to do exactly the same thing on our side. So on Tuesday, let's finalize this particular round. Let's finalize this particular round with what they are going to come up with and the concerns that every other member is going to make and the agreements that we've arrived on. So that on Wednesday, we are now able to go close by close on the bill. Because we'll be coming up with your key proposals that will be reflecting on the current bill. So then say, these are the key problems. I mean, the legal people will be looking into that. You know it better than anything else. So that when we meet then on Wednesday, we're able now to just go through it and agree on it. Members, I'm not, Mr. Shah, I don't want the media to come up and then say, I've surprised you.
No.
Not this time again.
I'm quite comfortable. I think that they have also been serious.
Sure, fine. Are we then agreeing, members, that we adjourn for now, for Tuesday, whereby now I can hear that you are saying, okay. I have to thank you. I have to thank you, and this has been a fruitful kind of engagement. And we have done sterling work by also accommodating some of the issues that the presenters last week came up with. Because we are also very careful where they would come up and then say you did not consider the issues that we raised. I'm quite happy again. I know that the document that we have circulated, it simply said restricted. But we have deliberately given it to the media. Because there's nothing secretive about it anyway. So I'm then saying thanks again, and the meeting is adjourned. Let's sing a lunch next to the door. I miss you. They're frustrating me. I said, no, I don't understand. I would have loved to hear you coming up there. Rosamund, please just give me to Brian so that he can...